Volume 3 was, you can tell, like, I haven't really got my mind around a lot of these ideas. So, but I guess one thing I would just say is that my impression is that, you know, it doesn't seem like the point of Marx's theory is really to explain necessarily necessity of crisis, to predict a crisis, or even to explain, like, the 2008 financial crisis, exactly what step led to. For me, it seems like the main thing is to point out just the limitations of the system that are always there, not just in a crisis, but anytime. The crisis just seems to expose those limitations. So I guess the main thing I wanted to say was that, for me, that's the sort of interest of crisis theory, not so much I'm going to predict, for example, is there going to be a crisis in 2022, or prove the necessity of crisis or the inevitability of crisis. It just seems like we can learn from crisis that the system has a real limitation. I mean, I guess it's a point we're always making anyway, but it seems like crisis dramatically reveals the limitation that's always there.
Yes, I see that. Mark, you would like to contribute, please go ahead.
Yes, thanks, Mike. Really very refreshing, stimulating. It's amazing because you always think that you're going to be studying Marx and you're going to think, oh, I've done that lots of times, so it's going to just sort of flow over me. And then you get something sort of bites. At least that's what happens with me. And there's lots of things I could say, but mainly to thank you very much. It was really very well organized material. But actually, the thing that bit me was this question that the whole thing that we've been, you know, brought up, and we live in the whole context of a period when technological development is linked to this drive for profit and effectiveness to create surplus value. And we live in that as though it's completely normal. So, you know, if we had been born in the, let's say, the feudal period, to make it nice and simple, you know, we wouldn't be, you know, looking at, I mean, maybe correct me if I'm wrong, but I put the thesis forward that we would be, for example, you're the son of a blacksmith, then your way of doing blacksmithery would just be the same as what your father did and your grandfather, and your child would do the same. And, you know, there was no economic reason to say, how can we make this more efficient? Because everything's good. You know, people come, they got a problem with their horse, and they say, we need some shoes. And you say, okay, I'm on it. You provide the shoes. They go away. They're happy. You're happy. And everyone lives in their world, this little ideal world that I've just described. Everything works. There's no drive. There's no need to go forward. I mean, in terms of technological process, why? Why would we progress? Why would we change anything? It's all good. And, you know, capitalism sort of came and took the world by the various parts of its body and just threw it around and created this dynamic which we're used to living in. So the idea that, you know, we would do that, we would use the same tools as our father and grandfather, or, you know, I don't want to be too male about it, but, you know, well, I mean, I have been, but I don't mean to be, is unthinkable to us and even ridiculous to us, because things move on and we do things more effectively. And as you pointed out, that this is because of the economic system in which we live, where, in fact, it's not about producing useful things. Useful things are just a means of making profit. So we're not about making useful things. We're about making profit. I mean, the system is. So we got to make more profit, and we got to work out how to do that, and we got to knock out our rivals, et cetera, et cetera. So there's this drive, this dynamic. Now, you transitioned right at the end to the issue of socialism, and you said, and I was glad you said it, that socialism is not going to be a world without crisis, because even if there are no economic crises, there will still be other crises. But what about the question, the counter question that will come, what will be the reason for any drive for any development within socialism? Won't socialism, or couldn't one argue that if you take away that drive that exists to constantly refine the processes and et cetera, that we're used to living in, and I think probably in many ways we expect, what will happen? Will we just sort of take all the tools that have been made so far and just, there'll be no drive. We'll be like in the feudal period, except we'll be picking up the instruments of a more developed period. We just won't have any need. Why will we need to change anything? What would your answer be? Or do you have any reflections on the question of, will socialism not be characterized by stagnation in terms of development? Anyway, I put that out as a counter thing to the... That's all I could think of. That was what bit me when you were talking.
Oh, you stumped me.
Mike, would you like to come in there?
I guess we've reached a point, though, where we can see the downside of this development. Certainly, I mean, environmentally and in other ways. So I don't know. Stagnation, maybe, yeah, by capitalist terms, it would seem like stagnation, I suppose. But we would probably have a way of, we'd be calculating things in such a different way. I mean, in such a more, both long-term, but also more qualitative way. So, I mean, I guess the lack of stagnation would just come from the fact that individuality developed under capitalism, I don't think is going to just sort of fall away. And I think individuals have their own drives for self-realization as well. And that finally, that drive for individual self-realization won't have to be in conflict with so many other people around us. They actually would be, we would be able to realize that's drive for self-realization through labor in a lot of ways. I mean, basically, everything sort of comes down, whether it's a hobby or anything, it sort of involves labor, I suppose, creating things or shaping nature to suit our needs. So I don't think that drive is going to go away. And finally, it'll be, yeah, I think there'll be more harmony. Certainly by capitalist standards, if you look at just the output of goods or something, it probably would be considered a stagnant society, I suppose. But I don't think we would experience it that way. That's just off the top of my head. I can't really answer very well.
I thought that was brilliant because you brought in the issue of how capitalism has actually stimulated individuality. I hadn't thought about that. You know, I mean, what I mean is I think we're not the same as we were in the feudal period or in the other period, were we? I mean, we've changed as well, people. So I think that's a really good direction in which to answer that objection. So thank you for that, Mike.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you. Right, Joy, I can see you in the speaking queue, but please go ahead.
Hi, it's not Joy, actually. It's Howard.
I am here.
It's Howard, but okay. Can I just say that I think there's another answer to Mark's question, or partial answer anyway. I remember when I was sort of first being introduced to socialist ideas many years ago, one of the people who was doing that said, look, what capitalism does, it turns people's lives upside down frequently. It's constantly organizing and reorganizing. And a lot of the time, people don't know where they are. And you only have to look around you to see that. He said, what people really want is a quiet life. And that's the kind of thing that socialism will give us. Okay, if we want to innovate, then there will be people who, you know, will put forward innovative ideas, which if the majority want to accept them, they will. But if they don't, they won't. So I think that's one of the answers to that question anyway. There will be sort of democratically agreed and moderated development that people want, not the sort of pell-mell stuff you get in capitalism, which, as I say, a lot of the time just turns so many people's lives upside down.
I would be happy with fewer new software programs to deal with and other things like that. Sounds good.
Okay, thank you. Steve, you're next, please. Steve, can you hear me? Paddy, can we go on to you, please, and we'll come back to Steve.
Yeah, sure. I just think, just going back to Mark's question, I think stagnation is the wrong word. I mean, it has all the wrong connotations, doesn't it? I mean, I think what we're talking about in socialism would be, a better word would be stability. in some ways, I think, you know, what we can see is in capitalism is this kind of, you know, pell-mell change for change's sake, just to exploit profit. One example would be, I think, drug companies, the big pharma. According to one Dutch study that I saw recently, up to 90% of new drugs don't do anything. They're essentially, they're duplicates of existing drugs that are only produced in order to get around existing patents. So you have an awful lot of innovation in capitalism, in technology as well. Software, it's the same thing, that doesn't really do anything. It's just to exploit profit by getting around, you know, existing patents and copyrights and things like that. Let's even leave aside innovation in the armaments industry and things like that. So there's a huge amount of stuff that there's a huge amount of change in capitalism that doesn't help people at all. But on the other side of that, I think in socialism you would see I expect that you would see a greater degree of standardization of production methods. So for example, let's talk about electric cars a minute. A lot of people are saying that it's a bit ridiculous having all these different electric cars with all these different types of batteries that all have to be produced in different factories and can only be used in one type of car. A logical, and of course they take hours and hours to charge. And a logical thing that you would talk about in socialism was, well, let's just have one battery, a standard size battery. Let's have a stock of charged batteries at every supply point, so that if you're going to have electric cars or buses or whatever, a vehicle needs to get a new charge, it just swaps out its battery. I think there are some bus systems that already do this. But this is just an example of how you would expect in socialism that production would be standardized in order to do this, so that, you know, components are standardized across different things. So that, I mean, and they're easier to take out, so you can recycle things, all these kind of things. So there would be much wider standardization in socialism. But the flip side of that, of course, is that in that case, it's more difficult to innovate because you've got to retool your entire production system every time you want to innovate. So there'd have to be a widespread discussion about, you know, hey, I've just invented a new way of producing something, or I've invented a better electrical plug, let's say, but the existing standard system, used possibly globally, would have to be retooled in order to get the benefit of this new innovation. Is it worth it? So there'd have to be a sort of widespread debate about, well, is it worth retooling our whole production system just for the sake of this one technological innovation, or should we just make do with what we've got? So I think in some ways, socialism innovation might be slower. Simply because of the need to, you know, retool. On the other hand, you wouldn't see this insane amount of, unnecessary innovation that we see in capitalism that doesn't really do anything and is just basically a waste of time and effort. That would be my contribution.
Mike, would you like to comment?
Oh, no, I guess I would just agree that the whole way of going about the whole debate over productivity would be just completely different, because you'd take into so many different factors that aren't taken into consideration under capitalism. First of all, you'd want to reducing labor time would be, of course, you would benefit directly from reductions in labor time, so that would be of extreme interest to everyone, I think. I mean, in capitalism, sometimes there's a lack of productivity too, because if there's an abundance of cheap labor, there's not a lot of motivation sometimes to introduce certain technologies that could be introduced, but it's not really worth it if you have access to exploitable, like cheap immigrant labor that you can exploit, or just why would you sometimes bother to do such things? So, yeah, I don't know. Sometimes capitalism isn't really as, I think that's one of the points I wanted to make, was that it has this drive to productivity, but that drive is always coming into conflict with the ultimate aim of profit. So I think it back in Smith's day, when it was just developing out of feudalism and everything seemed really rosy, and compared to feudalism, it was incredibly productive. So he could only sort of see that great side. But I think crisis was really a troubling phenomenon, because it did reveal that, wait a minute, you know, there is a limit here to this system, actually. So yeah, sometimes I think capitalism has this drive to productivity, but it's completely out of control. I mean, we don't really control it. So I think under socialism, there would still be a drive to do things more efficiently, just to make our lives easier. I mean, you don't want to have to labor 10 hours if you could do it for four, I would think. So there would be, I think, a huge interest in raising productivity.
Steve, please go ahead and try again.
Hi, can you hear me now?
Yes, yes.
Okay, thank you. Sorry about that before. Just to add something to this discussion about stagnation in socialism, in socialism, not under socialism. This idea that it's the capitalist system that's driving these the innovation now, as it's in no way distinct from what the workers are doing. I mean, as Marx points out, that you've got the benefits from labour being social in the capitalist mold, and you've also got all of the innovation, which actually Adam Smith pointed one out about how some child worked out a way to make his life easier. And you've got this occurring all the time, where workers are coming up with little ideas that make things more efficient, and you've seen it in UK, for example, in a more formalised manner with quality circles and things like that, and suggestion boxes. They're always asking people. Offering bonuses. Can you think of a good way to improve your work? And people do make these as you were suggesting, Mike, to make their lives easier. But then there's always the sort of alienated attitude that we've got. Well, what will it really benefit me in the end if I work more efficiently? I've come across this in my own working. You know, I've just I've not let on that something could be done better, because basically it did me no good whatsoever. So the freeing up of labour from the capitalist system is going to enable, I think, further development rather than less, and obviously with all these extra things that we're needing to take into consideration. Does it make for a better working environment? Is it more protective of the environment? Does it help individuals to develop, etc.? So having said that, could I just thank you for one thing that you brought up right at the very beginning of your talk, Mike? It's something that, because I've not got to volume four yet, this emphasis on the theoretical crisis. I thought that's very interesting indeed. It hadn't occurred to me how the introduction of money per se brings about the potential for crisis. That was that's the one thing that bit me. Thank you very much.
Oh, thanks, Steve.
Yeah, do you want to comment, Mike?
Oh, no, I just made some good points. I would agree with what you just said.
Right, okay, thank you. Adam, you can go ahead, please.
Okay, thanks. I just wanted to start by, I don't think that Mark is right about feudalism. It can't have been an entirely stagnant society. Otherwise, capitalism would never have developed out of it. I think what happened in feudalism was that there were improvements, but they were at a much slower pace than today under capitalism. And I imagine that will be the case in socialism. I wouldn't use the word stagnation. I think other terms that have been used would be steady state economy. Once society has reached the stage where it's producing what what people need, there's not all that much need to produce more, except for an increase in the population. But I think still there will be minor improvements going on, just as there were in feudal society. I suppose maybe in socialism, production will be what Marx called at one point simple reproduction or steady state economy. But to come back to your talk about the falling rate of profit, I mean, Marx specifically doesn't talk about the law of the falling rate of profit, but the law of the tendency of the rate of profit to fall. And he mentions various countervailing tendencies which slow down and can even negate the falling rate of profit, such as the cheapening of constant capital. If productivity means that machines themselves can be produced more cheaply. And the other one would be, of course, the increase in the rate of rate of exploitation. Instead of in your example it being 50%, it could go up. And in fact, that must be a tendency under capitalism as well. So I wonder if you'd like to say something about these countervailing tendencies.
Yeah, I guess I probably gave a bit of a wrong impression, but I should have mentioned that. But I guess my point wasn't so much that the profit rate falls and then that triggers a crisis. I think I just wanted to get more at how this sort of plays out, where there's this drive towards productivity, how that spurs competition, and then I guess the whole the point I'm trying to make is that there's, how does this potential for crisis actually, how does it actually become a reality? It seems like you have to look at this whole accumulation process itself, and like, it seems like my understanding is that this tendency toward the fall in the rate of profit, that does spur spurs more. I mean, it's sort of, I guess what I'm just, it's really hard to, I guess I didn't want to give the impression that I said that like that the fall in the rate of profit immediately triggers a crisis, so much as that there's this drive towards accumulation that tends towards the overproduction of commodities as a result. And then, I don't know. Can tell that my own thinking is really fuzzy actually when it comes to this whole question actually. I mean, that's why the second half of this talk got a bit fuzzy, but certainly Marx does not like present it as a law that like just plays out in a sort of one-directional sort of way. I mean, like you said, the rate of exploitation can increase, the actual value of constant capital can also fall. Yeah, so those countervailing factors. I don't know what I'm trying to say actually, but I have to work this out in my own mind a bit better.
Yeah, I must say it didn't come over as fuzzy in your talk, Mike. Adam, well, do you want to come? Adam, do you want to come back on that?
No, but I think that what I would argue was that, in fact, we can't tell which way the rate of profit will go in the long run. So I mean, I'm not even sure there is a long run tendency of the rate of profit to actually fall in practice. But I mean, I would agree that what provokes a crisis will be an overproduction of commodities, whatever the cause of it is. I think that's what provokes a crisis. But as I say, I'm not convinced that. What I'm saying is, it's indeterminate whether the rate of profit does fall, which tendency prevails. But
I guess my only focus would be more on how the logic for each capital involved, like what their logic in raising productivity, and I mean, as long as they can sell their own products, you know. And if they can sell, for example, at a lower price than the general market value, they can probably get rid of all of their products and realize their surplus value. But they don't really care much as far as what that means for the whole market. But if everyone's doing this, I mean, certainly there is this tendency. I mean, of course, markets do expand. There's credit. There's all these other things that make things quite flexible. Then you can open up new markets and whatnot. But it does seem like it's an extremely unstable and crisis-prone way to do it. I mean, the fact that each capitalist has just its eyes so narrowly focused on its own selling its own products and care less really if the market becomes saturated. I mean, which tends to happen, I think. But even that is probably a very simplistic explanation. So, yeah.
Thank you. Now, next in the speaking queue, if I say Rob, please go ahead.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, yes.
Hello. So, I'm Rob. I'm a friend of Steve's. We've in another group where we discuss socialist theory every now and again. I attended this talk today. And I just think I'd like to thank you, Mike, for a very interesting talk on capital, on crisis in capital. I think it's fundamental to understand where these areas can arise. But I suppose I've got kind of 2 points and one serious question. I suppose the first point is in relation to this kind of talk we've had about a stagnating society. And I think a lot of people have already kind of covered it very well in talking about how it won't be stagnant in the sense that there'll be, a society that I suppose by capitalist standards would be stagnant, but in terms of individual quality of life will be ever expanding. And to add to that, really, I'd like to kind of point out that innovation at the minute is quite hindered by capital, in that innovation is only promoted in areas where capitalists can see the potential for profit. If you think about the amount of kind of scientific papers that are turned down every year because their value is not realized by our system, you can kind of get an idea about how many different ways a society could expand with access to the capitalist means of production for common worker. So, it wouldn't be stagnant in that sense. I think it would be more a localized expansion of opportunity. And I'm always kind of taken back to that classic Marx quote of, from each according to his ability, to each according to their need. And, how many people's abilities are really wasted in the capitalist system? How many geniuses are tread down into the role of a wage worker when they could be, really utilizing their skills and knowledge in a more productive way? But through circumstance of birth, are locked into a system of labor till they die. And I think that happens to a lot of people in our society today, that, through the background and economic circumstances that they arrive into the world, their true potential is not realized. And I think in a socialist society, that potential will be very accessible. And the second point I wanted to make is in relation to the idea of crisis. Now, while I can see very clearly from the talk, Mike, and from my own readings of Capital, that crisis is kind of inevitable in the capitalist system through the kind of divergence of use value and exchange value, and credit and debt and all of these kind of factors that we've seen cause economic crisis in the past in capitalism. What I think is important to also note, though, is the actions that capitalism can take to adapt to the crisis. And my question is, is a crisis in capitalism really a crisis in capitalism, or is it a crisis for individual capitalists? And I suppose that would be my question. Thank you.
Right, thanks. Mike, over to you.
Yeah, well, the first point, yeah, was brilliant. Yeah, that's kind of what I was trying to say when to Mark's question. I thought that was very well put. All the wasted potential under capitalism is, yeah, it's infuriating, actually, to think about. You said, is it a crisis for capital, individual capitalists, or a crisis for capitalism itself? Is it, I think was the question. But yeah, I guess one thing when I talked about those definitions of basic definitions of crisis by Marx, I think the really important thing to note is he talks about the explosion of contradictions, which makes it sound like, you know, a crisis can sort of almost bring down capitalism. But he also says it's also the temporary resolution of those contradictions. So I think some Marxists seem to get rather overexcited about crisis and seem to view it as a sort of crisis in sort of the original medical sense of the term, like the patient could die or, you know, perhaps in a crisis. I think Marx maybe held that view when he was quite young, but he, I think, set it aside. So I wouldn't say it's a crisis of capitalism. Certainly it is a crisis for individual capitalists that get driven out of being capitalists. And so certainly for them, of course, for others, it's, you know, opportunity as well. So, yeah, I think for me, again, like I just sort of had a shift in my whole way of looking at crisis. Instead of, I guess I sort of approached crisis theory with the hope that I might be able to figure out, you know, the cause of crisis or the explain the inevitability of crisis or whatnot. But for me now, it just seems like the main point of the whole thing is it shows you that capitalism is a contradictory system, and it shows you the limits of this system. And Marx also says, you know, capitalism, it reveals these contradictions. And I think the crisis reveals these contradictions. So I think, I mean, crisis is more like, it's just a starting point for thinking about capitalism. I think for us, we're not trying to fix capitalist problems. We're not, actually, I think capitalists are more interested in finding, in a sense, the cause of crisis, although they never get further than like the trigger of crisis, really. But they want to find some way to solve this problem. And it seems like a lot of Marxists actually follow that same kind of path, and they want to sort of get at what's the cause. And a crisis is incredibly complex, and usually the immediate trigger is usually, you know, something on the level of related to credit or the finance system or whatever, and then everyone pins the blame on that. But that's just a superficial level, of course. But I think for us as socialists, I mean, our whole case comes down to the fact that capitalism can't be reformed, that it has these real limits that are always going to stand in the way of it being a system of production for use. It can't be. So I just feel like maybe crisis for us is, we don't have to get too worried about proving inevitability or making predictions or doing a postmortem on the latest crisis, all that stuff. I feel like, I don't know, for me personally, it just seems like instead of that, it's more of an opportunity for us to put our own, the case we're always making, but we can put it forth in a more sort of tangible way when during a crisis, maybe, because it's more, hopefully more apparent. Our case is more, I would think, more apparent. The case that capitalism is full of contradictions might be more clear, although from past crises, it seems like people draw strange conclusions, again, you know, blaming just the banks or whatever, and everyone has a culprit they come up with. But ideally, I guess I would just see crisis as a real opportunity for us to put forth our Okay, so I don't know if that answers the question. It's I guess I would say it's not a crisis of capitalism in the sense that it's going to bring about its downfall, but it does reveal the limits of the system, and certainly it is a huge crisis for individual capitalists. So obviously they take the strongest interest. Now, I think even just this week, you know, Japanese stock market went down on Friday, and there's all kinds of signs that the housing bubble might pop. So of course, individual capitalists take a huge interest in trying to figure out when this all might go south, since they have a lot of money in the game. But so, yeah, they take a sort of different approach, I think, than we would take. Sorry, I'm getting a bit off track here. But I would say it's not a crisis of capitalism in the sense of a threat to, mortal threat to the system.
Rob, does that answer your queries?
Yes, very much. And that was my own thinking of it. You know, even when these individual capitals, you know, lose out in a crisis, they, you know, ultimately kind of there are other capitalists who profit hugely from it. So it's that kind of, you know, yes, it's a crisis for some. And I think you made a very good point there, Mike, that it's kind of, you know, it's a chink in the armor, if you will. It's a point in which the socialists can make a good claim for reform, and you're right, it kind of lays bare the contradictions there. So thank you.
Okay, Mark, you can go ahead, please.
Yeah, I just wanted to quote something from Engels, who said, and I'm quoting now, "Every society based upon the production of commodities has this peculiarity that the producers have lost control over their own social interrelations. Each man produces for himself with such means of production as he may happen to have, and for such exchange as he may require to satisfy his remaining wants. Nobody knows how much of his particular article is coming on the market, nor how much of it will be wanted. No one knows whether his individual product will meet an actual demand, whether he will be able to make good his costs of production, or even to sell his commodity at all. Anarchy reigns in socialized production." And that word anarchy was something that sort of suggested itself to my mind when you were talking just I think well anyway I can't remember when, but the we're talking about the individual capitals in competition and Engels, at least in that section, sort of locates it down into the term anarchy. And I'm just curious as to what you think about, you know, when we're I'm thinking in terms of our, let's say, apologetics, that the way we talk to outsiders. Is it sufficient to say simply to draw attention to the fact that if you've got everybody just doing their own thing, each individually trying to maximize their profit without, of course, any reference to any generalized questions, just it's about earning enough money for my company so that we don't go under. My people need to earn money, so we have to produce. And it doesn't matter what we're producing as long as we're making money. And if we end up not selling it, we're going to have a problem, but we'll worry about it when it comes. You know, the anarchy of the marketplace, is that not a, that one word, is that not sufficient as an explanation of crisis within capitalism? And then doesn't that also then suggest what our counter proposal is, which is, let's say, to use the term, a planned economy, although that, yeah, of course, itself may raise some discussion. But I'm not sure if you used the word anarchy in your talk, Mike. You may have done.
That quote's quite good, but I guess the only I've seen anarchy used quite often. Many Trotskyist groups talk about anarchy, and the way, if you have the full quote that you just gave, it was, that's a brilliant quote. But the only problem I have maybe just using the one word anarchy is that it does suggest that we have, in some cases, I think groups really put forth this image that they have the way of taming the market through the state. So I don't, there's sort of that sort of image that pops up sometimes. Some groups seem to have this idea. They stress the anarchy, but then they seem to have this counter proposal that they're going to nationalize this or that, and then they're going to bring some sort of control over the situation without necessarily doing away with markets. But when you have the full quote from Engels like that, it's a very brilliant description of what the reality is. So in a way, the word is shorthand for that, but I think it could be misinterpreted as this notion that, again, the whole idea that maybe socialism equals a big state that's going to sort all this stuff out for us, which seems to be one of the huge illusions that still people that call themselves socialists seem to have this idea. So I guess that would be my only concern about the word anarchy.
Now, it says Joy, but is it Howard? Whoever it is, please go ahead.
Sorry, didn't want to say anything. I just wanted to sort of counter the idea that Mike's talk was in any way fuzzy. Not at all. It was an absolute tour de force. I didn't want to actually speak.
Sorry. Okay. Right. Thanks. So
I thought I was speaking into the void. So it's really hard to know. I'm a bit fuzzy, and you could tell from the response to Adam's question. So yeah, I need to work out a lot of this stuff. So, but thanks, Howard. That's nice to hear.
Could I just jump back in, Pat?
But yes, just briefly.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that quote comes out of Friedrich Engels's Socialism, Utopian, and Scientific. So it's part of part of a larger work. But I mean, it's pretty widely available. And in fact, in that section, he uses that term anarchy quite a lot. If anyone's interested in following it up, they could follow that up in Engels. I was also wondering whether there might not be a slight difference in emphasis there between Engels and Marx, but I've no idea whatsoever.
Thank you. Paul, you can go ahead now.
Thank you, Pat, and good morning, good evening, comrades, from a not so cynical man. Listen, there's nothing to feel ashamed about Marx being fuzzy. He is a bit fuzzy, you know, but Comrade Deutsch and I had a bit of a laugh recently, and we were talking in terms of Marx being the classic, you know, why use 100 words when 1,000 will do? But that was obviously his way of writing at that time. And it can be very complex. I'm hoping in the new year to go into my third listening of all three volumes of Marx, because each and every time previously I've listened to it on audiobook, it throws up another new dimension. Certainly the system, capitalism by its very nature, is chaotic. And when something's chaotic, there's no wonder that things go wrong. I mean, there was back in 2008 and Lehman's brother collapsed. In 2008, when Lehman's Brothers collapsed, it was it was like the perfect storm in terms of this huge bubble of debt that could no longer be managed because of all the different components not coming together when they should have done in terms of investment and production, and we all suffered from the fallout from that, not least of all the capitalists and the investors who backed Lehman Brothers. But what happens is, of course, it all gets written off. The system picks itself up, dusts itself down, and moves on, hopefully forwards. Certainly that is just an inherent nature of the system. When things don't manifest as an investments go pear-shaped, and you know, production falters and there's overproduction and all the rest of it, then inevitably things fall apart. I think when it comes to, I mean, human beings are, generally speaking, are very innovative and very curious and keen to try and find new ways of doing things. And the beauty of socialism is we won't have the fear and the worry of making losses from investments, because that side of things won't exist. The idea of production then will be purely for the benefit of the human species, while not at the expense of nature and the environment and animals and such like. So socialism by and of itself will be a very different means of production, as we all know, from need rather than profit taking priority. But in terms of capitalism being the sort of system that it is, there's no wonder that these you know, crises come round when they do, every now and again, because it's just not possible to predict with any real accuracy the way things are going to be needed. And such is the effect of overproduction. People get laid off. They don't have the money to spend on the next new round of production. And so we end up where we do. But I thought it was an altogether terrific presentation. You know, it was very brave of you to take it on, Mark. It's not an easy thing to not only get your head around, but to try and translate it into something more manageable. You know, as humble mere mortal workers would do well to, you know, to go over it if you ever can. I would certainly recommend going through. I mean, you don't even have to buy these things. They're freely available on YouTube, and actually just find a few quite. I know the whole set of three books takes about 150 hours of listening, but it's well worth persevering with it. You know, have a break whenever there's anything you're not sure about, and don't be afraid to ask for second opinions. I thought it was great, and the contributions this morning have been terrific too. So thank you all very much. Cheers. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. Cheers, comrades.
Art, you're muted.
Thank you. Sorry. Mike, I was... saying, do you wish to?
Oh no, thanks, Paul. No, I appreciate the comments. Yeah, but it's true. There's no surprise that capitalism falls into crisis every so often. Wouldn't be surprising if it happens next year, I suppose.
Yeah. Okay, Steve, you can go ahead.
Thank you. Could we just ask Mark to mute himself? Mark, could you please mute yourself? I just wanted to make it plain to people that this meeting is being recorded, so and it'll go onto the website and we'll be able to listen back to it. With it quite long, and I've also got a couple of files that Mike wanted us to. Wanted me to make available, and I will do that at the end of this session. It includes some of the quotes that Mike's referred to. So that's a bit of housekeeping. But I just wanted to come back to this idea of it being sort of enough for us to have this idea of crisis in general. Well, I don't think it is enough. I think we need to give more details to fellow workers, because I think most of us are like Boris Johnson. We're economically illiterate. We're possibly not as economically illiterate as Johnson, but we need to be able to provide more details to workers, exactly, not so that we can show off our wonderful Marx knowledge, but just so that we can explain why we're never going to be able to get the peace of mind that Howard referred to in, I think it was Howard, in capitalism, that we're always in essence going to be on edge as far as our economic present and future are concerned. And to do that, we've got to be able to talk about, for example, why the capitalist system with its reliance on credit is going to at some stage fall into crisis. And it cannot avoid it because of the contradiction between the productive system with its availability of credit and the potential for overproduction. This is something that is never talked about in standard economics. And of course, it is a key, and it's actually a development of the thing that you mentioned beginning, this disconnect between as soon as you've got money in the circulation of commodities, as soon as you've got that, you've got a potential for dislocation, which is magnified even more once you've got the modern credit system. And it's something that workers won't understand unless they've got a basic appreciation of Marx's arguments. So we need to go a bit further and just say, oh well, we've got a crisis, because it's always something that the capitalist economists or the capitalist politicians pretend that they can remedy, and they can't, because it's down to the very nature of the system itself. Okay, that's me.
Thank you. Now, there isn't anyone else in the speaking queue at the moment. Is there anyone else who's thinking about contributing but not quite made it? I'll just give you a moment or two to think about it. We have now, the meeting's gone on for, sped past, as it were, for an hour and a half. Is that, Paddy, I can see you there, but so I won't natter on. You go ahead, please.
Thanks. Well, you asked if there was anything anyone was thinking about, and I was thinking about something. I'm not sure how important it is, but Mike, at some at a certain point, I think you were talking about Circulation, Volume 2, which is one I haven't read actually yet. So, and you said, if I remember right, you said crisis is not so much the overproduction of commodities as an overproduction in capital itself. I wondered if you just kind of return to that point a minute, because in Volume 1, you know, there is this kind of disconnect between sale and purchase, where you pointed out, you know, that just because you've sold a commodity for money doesn't mean you then have to go and buy something with that money. So, you know, if there's an overproduction in capital, doesn't mean that that capital has to be then reinvested in production. So I just wondered if you want to, that sort of slightly doesn't add up to me. If you want to just kind of enlarge on that.
Sorry, go ahead. Someone else talking there?
No, carry on.
Should I go ahead? Okay. I think that was actually from Volume 3, but that's one of the fuzzy bits. Like the relation between the overproduction of commodities and what he calls the overproduction of capital, I couldn't quite sort that out. My understanding of overproduction of capital would be the point where you, even when you're investing more capital, it's not really, the return you're getting is sort of, it's not making it worth your while to invest more capital at that point. So if it reaches that point where there's sort of no motivation for further investment. But this is one of the points I really, because when he's in that part of Volume 3, he talks about both of these concepts, and I maybe someone else knows this better than me, but the relation between them is like not really clear to me actually. I especially like the notion, I mean, overproduction of commodities is pretty clear. It's just, you know, literally can't sell them. I mean, the market is saturated, or there's just no way to sell, make a sale of your commodities. But yeah, the overproduction of capital for me, the way it's explained, I couldn't quite get my mind around it, actually. So that's a good question.
Does anyone else want to come in there? And there are times when the government in the past has been begging for people money to be invested. Whereas we know if there's not a prospect of profit, then the money won't be invested. So I from that point of view, I don't quite see the problem with the
that's very clear way of putting it. Yeah, that's maybe that's, yeah, that's a nice way of putting it. So clear.
Nice. So, well, I don't know. I suppose if you've got capital, maybe you want it to be growing, but not having that problem.
I'm just wondering if to what extent that could be. Sorry if I speak, Pat. Sorry, folks.
Yes, there's no one in the speaking queue. You may go ahead.
Thanks, Pat. So I'm wondering if to what extent, when we've interpreted that, as Pat rightly puts it, you know, the money kind of just basically sits there doing little or nothing. And there's also the element of people trading in money. In other words, there's not anything being produced per se, but money is being bought and sold and exchanged across currencies. So that by and of itself, because there's not a productive element to it, that might be one way of explaining that sort of what he terms as the overproduction. Was that the right term? I got the overproduction of money. I'm wondering if that was his thinking at that point. Yeah.
Did you want to come back, Mike?
Oh, no. I was just saying the term he used was overproduction of capital. But yeah, I mean, basically, my take was similar, that it just reaches the point where there's no real incentive to throw more capital into that particular production because it's not going to yield much, if any, additional profit.
Right, I can see that maybe changed his mind. Someone started. Sorry, Rob, would you like to go ahead?
Yes, I'll go ahead. In relation to the overproduction of capital and, you know, that being a grounds for crisis, you know, if we look at back into the, you know, at the historic examples of crisis that we have, you know, for instance, if you look at the 1920s economic kind of crash in the stock market, 1929 and the Great Depression and the kind of build up to that, you see that, you know, that one of the major contributing factors was kind of overspeculation from the financial sector. You know, that they were investing money that they borrowed into areas that didn't yield a profit, which caused a massive shortfall between the exchange value and use value of that of the commodities they were investing in, which then led to the, you know, decline in these individual capitals that were involved. But again, I think it's important to kind of come back to the idea that it is only individual capitals that suffer in a crisis. That the kind of big, the main body of capital or the major moving components of capital, you know, the kind of big capitalist hordes retain their position at the top of the economic system, even in a time of crisis. Because they for them, you know, their loss may be a few million in investment, but, you know, compared to the size of their hoard, it is actually a minimal difference for those capitalists, and they can then shift that into kind of resolving the problems created by the crisis. So if we go back to our historical example of the 1920s crisis, what you see as a kind of response to that is, you know, partly to do with the Second World War and the production of arms. But also the kind of invention of the social state, you know, the invention of the welfare state in most Western democracies, as a kind of, you know, even if there is crisis, the worker continues to profit. But then if you look at the most recent economic crisis, 2008, which may speak, you know, more to the changing conditions of the worker, that crisis wasn't met with anywhere near the kind of political resistance that it was met with in the 1920s, and in fact, if anything, it's led to kind of the government policy of austerity, which is actually a removal of these kind of the social props that we formerly relied on in order to prop up the failing capitalists at the top of the system. You know, so rather than allowing the chaotic death of one mode of capital and the emergence of a new one, they have, you know, kind of artificially created life support for the old systems by generating capital from other areas. So, you know, for me, I think with crisis comes also the adaptability of capitalism. And you know, that there is this crisis created, but then is then mitigated by the system, on a kind of workers level anyway. I don't know if that was really a coherent thought or if it was any use to anybody, but I made it anyway.
It definitely, sorry, if just
no, carry on, Mike.
But yeah, it does seem like ever since the Great Depression and, you know, the crash in 29, certainly on the left, people have always seemed to expect that the same thing is going to happen, like this going to play out the same way, and then it's going to be an opportunity for the left. And it really hasn't ever quite worked out that way. So certainly, yeah, capitalism has ways of adapting, and then, you know, with quantitative easing and whatnot, they can sort of reinflate bubbles. And there's a limit, though. I'm curious this time around, you know, after all of the stimulus and everything, you've lowered interest rates to the point where you can't lower them anymore. You do reach a point where, from the capitalist perspective, it's not going to be quite so easy, I think, this time around. I wouldn't make any predictions like, oh, there's going to be a crash like in the 20s, because like you're saying, I mean, it's also an opportunity. And again, yeah, it's an explosion of contradictions, but then it's also is a way of, that's the way that a new sort of equilibrium, if you can call it that, is achieved. So yeah, I mean, we can't really look to crisis as like going to take care of all the problems. It's not going to get rid of capitalism for us, that's for sure. So capitalism, way of adapting. And then, I mean, the difference between this crisis and the Great Depression, there's so many differences as well that need to be analyzed. And like Steve was saying, I mean, I think I actually was making a bit of a cop-out, say, oh, we don't need to go into too much detail. I think that's just because, again, my own understanding is really frustratingly limited. So it would be great to be able to actually explain in more detail what's going on and give workers a better idea of, like, you know, what to expect is coming around the bend. But yeah, it gets really complicated. And then again, I think that every time a crisis breaks out, it usually breaks out in the financial sector. So much attention is focused on that. But I think usually the speculative bubble that is the last point in the boom, it's usually like money's flooding into the stock market and the housing market precisely because in the productive sector, they can't, maybe it is an overaccumulation of capital in those sectors where you can't make the profit you can make on speculation. So then with all the cheap money poured into the system, it's not surprising that the stock markets can defy gravity for years. I don't know how much longer they can, but so I think we tend to sort of see the speculative bubble, and everyone seems to put the blame for crisis on that, when in fact, it's really just a sort of outcome. Like I was saying, this sort of drive for productivity that's driving the smaller capitals out of the market, those capitals have to resort to often swindle, speculation. So there's a huge speculative bubble that arises sort of at the peak of this, of a boom period. And then I think everyone pins the blame on that. It's like, oh, look, you know, got out of control and they forgot about fundamentals and blah, blah, blah. But like, it certainly seems to happen every time. So there is a certain, obviously, necessity or inevitability of these speculative bubbles. And they are related to the real economy in the sense that, like I said, I think that the fact that there aren't real opportunities to make a decent level of profit in the productive sector does probably drive this speculation as well. So, yeah, certainly each crisis is a bit different, and capital adapts, and it's always going to be an opportunity for large capital to really, like in the 2008 crash, I mean, people swept in and then bought up properties, and then they made a bundle on the next, you know, housing bubble. So, yeah. The large capitalist will tend to be okay, I suppose, yeah. Sorry, that got a bit long.
Steve, I can see you in the speaking queue. My attention was just diverted for a moment. I was looking something up. Are you wishing to speak?
Yes, please. It was merely to point out the presentation that we had from Kleiman several years ago about the about that 2008 crash, and he looks at he puts some very good arguments forward for that. So I'm just going to put that into the speaking queue for people to refer to it if they wish at a later stage, if that's okay. So it's just that. Very interesting talk, that one, as well, by the way.
Thank you. Well, now the meeting has been going on for nearly 2 hours. Is that seems to be a perhaps a suitable point to draw to a close. And I would ask Mike, do you wish to sum up in any way or just briefly?
Just might mention, Steve talked about he's going to put some files. I think he's going to link to some files. For the past couple of years, actually, the reason I've gotten so sort of into this and it is that I've been translating this book by this Japanese guy that he's written a lot on crisis. And one of the things he did was he published 4 volumes of Marx writing on crisis. So he basically tracked down everything Marx wrote on crisis and tried to organize it into sort of a system of crisis theory, what he thought was kind of crisis theory Marx might have written if he ever finished that book on crisis. And so that's one of the things they're going to be linked to. So this book I'm translating, I included a table of contents for those 4 volumes of Marx writing. So when you see the file that Steve puts up, it's going to be the table of contents. And then it also has the volume numbers from Marx Collected Works and the page numbers. So if anybody is a complete masochist out there, they can look up everything that basically Marx wrote on crisis, and it's organized under various headings. So you can see that basically my talk today, when I was talking about the essential definitions of crisis, that came from that book. That's where I found those passages, and that passage in Theories of Surplus Value that explains Marx's method to crisis theory, that also comes from there. So anyway, just so you know, it's originally published in German and Japanese, but I tracked down the quotes for this book I'm translating. So again, and by the way, if you go to archive.org, you can also find the 50 volumes of Marx and Engels Collected Works. I think it's still there. So if you want to track down any of these quotes yourself, between the file that Steve's going to upload and then archive.org, you can do that if you're really into it. but yeah, again, so like for the past year I've been working on this translation, and it's just frustrating that after all this time, I still feel like I really have a lot to learn. I feel like, in fact, I almost feel more confused than when I started. So I'm hoping at some point everything will come together and it'll make more sense. But yeah, I feel like now I know just enough to like have confused myself completely. So I probably would have anyway, but so yeah, that's, and this book might come out next year. When it comes out, I'll let you know, but it's, yeah, it's a book. It's going to be titled In Pursuit of Marx's Theory of Crisis. And it's basically all the writings of this Japanese guy in Kuruma on Marx's theory of crisis. So I'll let everyone know when that comes out. But thanks. Yeah, thanks again for all the great questions and contributions today.
Thank you very much for the talk, and as been said, it was very clear, very, very pleasure to listen to. To thank everyone for taking part, I could just refer to, sorry, I thought someone spoke, refer to chapter 23 and I can't see because I'm looking at notes I did for a talk some years ago, and it's where Marx refers to the cotton famine in 1866, when capital was hunted out of the usual sphere into chief centres of the money market. And for that reason, the crisis now assumed a predominantly financial character. The outbreak in May 1866 was signalled by the failure of one of the leading banks, promptly followed by a number of bubble companies. One of the great London branches of industry involved in the catastrophe was the building of iron ships. During the giddy period of speculation, the magnates of this industry had engaged in overproduction to an enormous extent, but had also undertaken huge contracts for others, acting on the supposition that the sources of credit would continue to flow abundantly. There followed a terrible reaction in other London industries. Right, well,
sounds familiar.
So there, I would go back to thanking you, Mike, for that very pleasurable to listen to talk, and thank everyone for taking part, and meeting to a close.